We come to the 12th presentation in this set. And next week will be not the 13th, but as we're used to, an interval that arranges the set of the 12 into a harmonic. So it will be, in musical composition terms, a tonic key. I'm going to do two things today. One, the last 2 weeks, I've been reading my own science fiction in excerpt so that you get the sense that when I'm talking about the future vision of science fiction, I'm talking from the standpoint of somebody who's been familiar with this for more than half a century and who was a personal friend of many of the greats of science fiction. My first published letter was in this May 1957 issue of the original science fiction stories. And it's interesting because it only has two letters. The other is by Isaac Asimov. So I was first published with Asimov, and I'm going to talk about Asimov today, the Foundation series especially, a future history series. But I'm also going to read the first 6 or 8 or 9 pages of another science fiction novel of mine, Moonfruit. And that will also give you a sense that we're on a threshold now for events that will play out very quickly in the next couple of decades. And in that time span, this Moonfruit is set in 2066 on the moon. Next year will be 2010, so that's only 56 years away. I can easily remember back more than 56 years myself, so it's not improbable that youngsters who are here, young people who are here and viable, will certainly be alive in 2066. And we'll come to appreciate and understand that our particular generation, our particular time, was not only a turning point or a tipping point. It isn't that there are points like that. One of the deepest ways to appreciate that is to take the current concept of zero-point energy. Here's a page from our notes. Zero-point energy is a distracting idea. In a way, it is a chimera. Zero is a field, and that's the point. Period. Vacuum energy baffles. Tau perfumes Te, to utilize high Dharma Bodhisattva language. Te is energy, the energy to be. Existence, existentiality, actuality. Te emerges out of the zero field Tao into oneness all the time. It's iterative. So that energy, in its existentiality, is a frequency and is specific in terms of whatever is emerged. Every particle, every combination of particles into larger onenesses become energized to a specific frequency. An electron is 0.511 electron volts. They all are, no matter how many untold gazillions. That's the energy frequency of an electron. The fact that an electron can jump twice and have two other energy levels is remarkable. But each of the three energy levels of an electron has a neutrino, and the neutrinos are almost massless ghost particles. And they can move acrobatically in between the three levels of the energy and not be compromised by it. But once a polarization is sensed for an emergence, the iterations will always specifically and exactly be that, unless they are jumped in terms of energy or lessened in terms of energy, in which case you get a transformation, but the transformations are not wild in the sense that they are haphazard, but the transformations can be foreseen. If one understands eventually why energy is always specifically calibrated, one can understand finally that there is a curious architecture to not only nature and the world and existence, but there is a very complex architecture to the further dimensions of transform that affect space-time. The earliest record of this triad, this tripartite level of manifestation, as I used to call it, or of energy frequency, of existentiality in its transforms, came from first century Alexandria, where the term for the ultimate wisdom teacher was thrice greatest, Hermes Trismegistus. Hermes, the guide of our spirit, of our souls, the messenger of the gods to man, the maker of the first musical instrument that was able to go to a full harmonic, and that is Apollo's lyre, was made by the young Hermes the thief. His first action was to steal the cattle, the cows, to rustle Apollo's herd, and agreed to give them back and to pay Apollo a little dividend by making a 9-string lyre. When you had a 7-string lyre with Orpheus, you could make a certain kind of music, but with a 9-string lyre, all of a sudden the harmonic expands and includes not just the 7, but includes an 8th, by which a 9th is attainable. And once one has, in the ancient thrice greatest Hermes language, once you have an 8th that reveals a 9th, one is able for the first time to hear singing from a 10th, which was completely beyond, never even suspected. The 9th itself was not suspected because it was a complementarity of 2 sets of 4 into an 8, an ogdode, an octave, an 8-part, which meant that there were 4 pairs in the 8, and that the deepest registry of existentiality is that it does not just occur in singlets or in unities, but that the unity itself has a symmetry. And that symmetricality is best expressed in our time, in our language, as being paired. And that it goes even deeper than that, that pairedness can itself be paired, so that you can have a pair of pairs, or you can have pairedness squared. But it can also be taken and jumped in dimensional energy to a third level, in which case the pair is cubed, so that the relationship between the cubed pairedness and the squared pairedness, between the eightness and the fourness of the symmetry, gives one a composing ratio which is golden. It allows for one to be able to see into hidden structure and to use an expanded imagination, a creative imagination that is no longer limited to images of something actual, but delivers to us an image base of possibilities. In which case, now we have the ability to creatively imagine something completely new, which will be able to take its level, not just in something actual initially, but something that becomes actual through transformation. And that becoming actual through transformation means that now possibility is more comprehensive than actuality. And that creative imagination now has a double transform of which it is capable. It is capable of creatively making something artistic rather than just existential or phenomenal, or something which is phenomenal and mental, that the symbolic structure is able to correlate in identification with the arrangements of phenomenality, but there is now a transparent that comes to the symbolic structure of thought, where one can not only use the reflection looking back, but one can use a transparency looking forward. One can foresee as well as identify. And that the balance between looking back and looking forward gives the mind an ability to achieve a complete equanimity. And when it achieves a complete equanimity, the transparency of possibility of the future and the identification, identity structures of the past are permeable to each other, so that they now form a new kind of time, not a time of the past mediated by the present, moving to the future, but the present moment as a point becomes the field of equanimity. And because that field of equanimity does not have phenomenality in its liminals at all, it is infinite. So that a meditation, yoga, is able to establish eventually through practice and through application, through the ability to foresee possibilities, one is able to come to an equanimous state of the structure of symbolic thought in which all symbols are able to do two things at the same time. They're able to work reflectively by pragmatic correlation, but they're able to work prismatically by possibility. And so those two together come and are opened, they're tied in a bow which is open by a third. This is an ancient wisdom. There was a Roman historian named Ammianus Marcellinus. He wrote in the 300s AD. And he has a little paragraph about ancient Celtic wisdom. And I thought it would be interesting just to hear someone writing about 1650 years ago about Celtic wisdom, of which very few people at that time in the Roman world really had any idea. And this is his paragraph. Throughout these regions, men gradually grew civilized and the study of the liberal arts flourished, initiated by the bards, the Yuhages, and the Druids. Now the bards sang to the sweet strains of the lyre the various deeds of famous men composed in heroic verse, but the Yuhages, investigating the sublime, attempted to explain the secret laws of nature. The Druids, being loftier than the rest in intellect and bound together in fraternal organizations, as the authority of Pythagoras determined, were elevated by their investigation of obscure and profound subjects, and scorning all things human, pronounced the soul immortal. So the Celtic triad was bards, Yuhages, and Druids. The three are the reflection back, the contemplation forward, and the meditation balancing both and introducing a field of infinity, which is the field of consciousness. But the field of consciousness is in a complementarity with the zero field of nature. So that in an equanimity, zero and infinity are able to be interchanged without losing anything in a logical structure. One can easily bring oneself to this equanimity where your practice is balanced by your foresight, where your pragmatic is balanced by the prismatic. And what comes out of this then is that the mind achieves an openness where it is equally at home with a transcendental spirit person organizing the application of the mind, or by the physical, phenomenal, body, individual organizing it. The old way of talking of this is body, mind, and spirit. But that again is a distracting idea of what the triad is. To appreciate, one has to understand the zero field of nature engenders emergence in a cycle. It's an integral cycle. And that initially the mind is made, literally evolved, to be an integral structure making to complete that cycle, and is capable of doing so. And the completed mind was a distinctive function of our species when we first came into being about 200,000 years ago, Homo sapiens. We could make a complete understanding of natural cycles, and we're able to not only survive and thrive, but to eventually become capable of bringing the energies of the integral cycle of nature to its up to then finest point. We were able to see how plants in their cycle lived, how animals in their cycle lived, how minerals in their cycle lived. And all of this was apparent because the first energy jump of our species about 40,000 years ago from Homo sapiens to Homo sapiens sapiens was the development of art, which meant that they transparency of the symbolic structure allowed not only the vision of differential consciousness to creatively play, but to creatively play in such a way as to make prismatic forms. And the art forms in the Paleolithic era were exceedingly refined. 100 years ago, 140 years ago, when they were first noted, the big bulls at Altamira in Spain on the ceiling were first seen in the 1860s. So a nine-year-old girl who was the first to see them. Her father was an explorer of these caves, but never looked up. She, being nine, in the torchlight looked up, and there was the great mural of the bulls. It isn't that they're just images of the bulls, but they're a vision of a whole gestalt of the bulls, arranged as if it were a constellation in the sky, multiplied many times over. And for almost 100 years, it was thought that Paleolithic art was a peculiarity on a level of like children learning to draw, until about 30 years ago, a chemical analysis was made of the colors of Paleolithic art, and they were found to be very complex formulas of composition. The clays, the manganese for the black, and the various minerals used were collected over huge areas of hundreds of miles and brought together and mixed in exact proportions to get the palette for Paleolithic art. And when one realizes that the only light that they had were little hand-size clay structures that were filled with animal fat that made handheld light, candle-light, and were able to paint enormous, complicated corridors and chambers of imagery that linked together in such a specific way that one could come finally to understand composition on an aesthetic level 40,000 years ago was almost immediately refined. That the emergence of the new refinement of our species happened, obviously, very quickly. Not in geologic times, not even in evolutionary times, but in terms of maybe a couple of generations of human lives. My favorite discovery was that with Lascaux, when they realized Lascaux was found in 1940, when they realized that the visitors to Lascaux, that the exhaling of their breath was beginning to fade the pictures, they decided to close Lascaux and flood it with an inert gas, but that they would make a duplicate of Lascaux so that future generations of visitors could come and experience the mystery of the cave. And in doing so, they had to meticulously reproduce the amazing colors, and this is what led to the discovery that these are very complex formulas. These are our artists' oils, as it were, of the kind of refinement that one would find in like Renaissance paintings. Somebody figured out the formulas and passed it on for not only generations, but for thousands of years intact. That's a level of a civilization. That aesthetic civilization has had a second distillation that has happened over the last 2,500 years in terms of analysis, in terms of science. The first distillation of our species was through art. The second distillation is through science. What led to art was the field of vision, and what leads to science is the complex flow of history. And in order to master history into science, one first has to come to the appreciation of art from vision, which has a further sense of preliminary, in that one has to understand that just because a cycle is complete, that's not the end of it. Because completion can be transformed into perfection twice over. And so our new species, I've named it Homo sapiens stellaris, is a double refinement of the original species that we have been for 200,000 years. The first transformation is a fermentation. Vision ferments, and out of this, the water becomes wine. But the second transformation is a distillation where the wine becomes a cognac, a champagne. It's one thing to have wild grains, the wild goat grass, which occasionally would mutate itself into a higher grain number on the stems, and they could be selected out and you would get more grain. But eventually there was a transform where a second application made not only just a few grains, or maybe 6 or 8 grains, but made 30 some grains, and one got bread wheat. But the bread wheat used all of the energy of the plant, so that instead of having the natural husks as wings so that the wind would seed the grain, bread wheat falls exactly where it is. And it's only by the hand of man sowing the seeds that one can have bread wheat. And so bread becomes an aesthetic fermentation of the original natural. But here's something further. One can learn to roll out the flour very thin from bread wheat and put a very minute layer of butter, and then roll out another very thin and more butter, and you can make maybe 100 different levels like this, and when you bake it, you don't get bread, you get a croissant. So when you next have a croissant and a glass of champagne, what you're dealing with now is an analytical achievement. It's the science of being a not only a chef, but being a creative, great chef, of coming up with foods that are startling. They have never been seen before, at least on this planet. The quality of our time is to be able to review quickly how we came through all of these layers, and to open us up to the threshold where almost anything is possible now. There are some companies that have literally written their name in atoms. IBM. The ability to make super refined femtofilms of molecular actions has been around for about 10 years, 12 years. Pioneered here at Caltech by an Egyptian Arab genius, Ahmad Zewal. Femtochemistry. And now atochemistry of atomic level actions are well within reach. We know that the achievement of the elements being arranged in this table of families of elements has become familiar, but the same elements can be arranged in a pyramid form as well, and it holds. And can be arranged in a helical form of the chambered nautilus, and it holds. Can be arranged in free-form squiggles, almost like a drunk Matisse, holds. The ability to understand that an analytic is not freeze-drying the world, but opening up the aesthetic appreciation to an analytic perfecting. I want to come to Moonfruit, if we have enough time to do a few pages, just to give you the sense of the prophetic quality. Moonfruit is in five sections. It's the five sections of the moon: the full moon, the waning gibbous, the last quarter, the old crescent, and then the new moon. This is from full moon. This is how it begins. Granny saw everything she looked at, a crack perceptor. The old familiar moonscape was out there, rounded by a forever micro rain, lunar scape indeed. And inside this lunar tour bus, silently cruising 1,000 meters up, her youngsters were restless for adventure, thank goodness. Two pairs of boys, one pair snickering over a successful prank planned on wrist PCs, another pair quiet with subtle plans to annoy others, and a loner quietly observing all the others, including three girls clustered around Nokomis, a gorgeous 19, and teaching others eight more living jewels radiant under Granny's and Nokomis's wisdom cutter tutelage. Granny's third generation of raising lunar natives, as she called them. And they called that moonscape out there the Lorraine, not the terrain. Lovingly, a new terrain for mankind, in fact, a larger land surface than that of beautiful old Terra up there in the south. Her hand came up to touch the transparent glass that actually blossomed out of the ceramic body of the craft, more genius engineering materials of Edgers, her favorite youngster of past decades, Nokomis's dad by adoption in 2047. Her hand was still feminine, not bad for a 90s-year-old babe, low 90s. She let tour bus sounds recede. Decades since her hand was last kissed, in those early days here, that had been her desperate genius lover, long gone away. Now, rumor says he's coming back, but old, ready to die and to be buried in the cakey dust of eternal imbrium. Her eyes did not tear anymore for Reston. They were softened as the rounded vistas of Luna. Fingers that still gave graceful touch to special glass through which Granny again focused on the Lorraine of her homey world, full breath refresh, full moon zenith, very bright and hot out there. Rembrandt tones, some Churyosco darks, grays, light tones, the Lorraine gently morphed outside the generous port, one of six on this side, a magnificent show, a slow ballet, an ultimate high desert beauty, 4.4 plus billion years silent. Granny's spirit loved primal dimensions, nourishment for real maturation. This was maybe her 30th trip out here, always an adventure, often with new kids. She checked a reading. Good. They were on final approach to the historical site of Apollo 15, Mount Hadley region. Nokomis would have them prepped right. One pair of boys, two 10-year-olds, Taro, Japanese, and Jared, Australian, again busy gloating over their latest hacking triumph. All the toilets at the Plato Dome construction site now flushed in staggered phase, with seats flapping to attention in sequenced syncopation area by area and floor by floor throughout the monumentally gigantic tower. What a kick in their new you-know-what. Granny paid no attention. Boys, let Nokomis handle it. Let's take a break.